So let's start by going back to what we discussed yesterday. And that is the question of where ethics begins. We noticed that we are reactive and that reactions, inclinations, sankhara, are simply part of what we are as a sentient organism, as a human being. Reactivity, reactions, they're part of what we have evolved in the course of our thousands of years to ensure and to support our survival. So simply to react is not in itself ethical. It's simply what happens to us. Even if we're caught up in, let's say, a very destructive and neurotic pattern of thinking and emotion, is that unethical? Is that immoral? When you're sitting on a cushion and you are consumed with a fantasy, for example, and a strong emotion, maybe there's hatred there or some other powerful feeling. Is that unethical? Is that immoral? And I would say no, it's not. And there's nothing to feel guilty about. There's something innocent, unschuldig, about the simple ways in which the organism reacts to its environment, its situations. And in a similar way, we could ask, when we find ourselves in a non-reactive state of mind, let's say a state of mind in which we naturally feel open and kind and concerned, is that ethical? Is that an ethical state of mind when it arises quite naturally and spontaneously? I would argued that it's not yet ethical, that it is a condition that might give rise to ethical behaviors, but those feelings, those emotions that we might experience in meditation or in the course of life are no more or less ethical than the anger and the desire that arises spontaneously within us. For me, ethics has to do with actions, with handlungen. This, I think, came through quite clearly in some of the presentations on Friday. Ethics is about how we act, and it's not about how we feel. Of course, our feelings might then lead us to act in a certain way. If I feel anger towards somebody, I can then give voice to that anger and say something very cruel and unkind. Then we're in the realm of ethics. That those words, intentionally spoken to cause harm or to cause discomfort or embarrassment in the other person, that is an ethical act. And it will have consequences on the other person, clearly. The other person will feel hurt, let's say. But it'll also have consequences on us. It will perhaps reinforce that tendency to behave angrily again. Or it might make us feel that we've let ourselves down, that we've somehow failed to act according to our deepest values. So Handlungen, actions, have consequences on others and on ourselves. And that is something we can observe. And my sense of the Buddha's understanding of karma, and remember karma, or kamma in Pali, karma simply means action. It doesn't mean anything else. There's nothing weird and mystical attached to the idea of karma. It's just action. And it's I think it's probably a good idea to stop using that word, karma, because it has a lot of baggage with it. And in terms of the sort of mindfulness practice we're doing, I feel that it is very important to be mindful of our motives, to be mindful of our feelings, and to be mindful of how we act, and to be mindful of the consequences of our actions, both on others, on the world, and on ourselves. So in that sense, mindfulness is not just about introspection, not just about looking within ourselves, but it's also very much about being attentive and aware of the consequences of how we act, what we say, what we do in the world. I also feel that mindfulness is a kind of recollection, which is what the word literally means. It means to remember. And this is a remembering or a recollecting of our goals and our values. When I was first introduced to mindfulness through the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it was largely understood as being mindful of one's commitments, being mindful of one's motives, being mindful of one's goals and purposes. That's what it meant to be mindful. Quite different in a way to how mindfulness is understood today, particularly in the medical applications of mindfulness, in the way it's presented in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, which is much more about being mindful of our ongoing moment-to-moment experience of our body, of our feelings, of our perceptions, of our mental states, of our hindrances, and so on. My sense, therefore, is that we could benefit, I feel, by bringing these two perspectives together. That mindfulness is both an awareness of my actual bodily and mental condition at any given moment, but it is also mindful of what I regard as my ethical life. In other words, I'm mindful of aspiring to be a particular kind of person, to aspire, to wish, to live the best possible version of myself. And to have that in mind, in traditional Buddhism, this is expressed in the idea of the mindfulness of the Buddha, mindfulness of the Dhamma, mindfulness of the Sangha. These are also described in the Pali texts as practices of mindfulness. And Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha don't refer to some external objects in the world. They refer to our core values that inform how we seek to live. In other words, I aspire to lead a life that is more Buddha-like than Mara-like, if you wish. I aspire to lead a life that that engages with the middle way, with a particular practice. I aspire to live a life that creates and develops a certain sense of community and belonging. These are also practices of mindfulness that make it quite clear that mindfulness is already ethical in the sense of it being the framework of values, the awareness of how we are moment to moment, and crucially, how we then act. It's the two things, awareness implicitly of what we aspire to live by, awareness explicitly of my feelings and emotions and thoughts and so on, and awareness of how, when those two things come together, I'm challenged to speak and talk and act and work in a way that conforms to my values and is acutely aware of whatever is arising within me that supports those values, like, let's say, generosity and wisdom, and whatever it is within me that goes against those values, hatred and fear and so forth. Now, when we look at the Dharma in terms of it being a practice centered around four tasks, then immediately we are saying that the Dharma is effectively ethical through and through. If we feel that our Dharma practice is founded on a set of truths, the Four Noble Truths, for example, our basis is effectively an assent to hold a particular understanding of the world about dukkha, its origins, its cessation, and the way that leads to it. We regard those four principles as truths, non-negotiable truths. So the foundation for our practice becomes metaphysical. In other words, we hold beliefs about the world that are not evident to our experience. Buddhists will believe that craving and ignorance are the cause of suffering. And suffering is defined as birth, sickness, aging, death, and so on. That's not something we know. It's not something we can demonstrate or prove. I cannot prove to you that craving and ignorance are the cause of old age, for example. That's not something I can explain. But that's what is believed broadly in Buddhism. What happens when this gets secularized, when the Four Noble Truths get secularized, they tend to turn the Dharma into psychotherapy. In other words, when asked, why is craving the cause of old age? They would say, well, what that means, really, is not that craving causes me to get old, but it causes me to be unable to accept being old. In other words, it generates mental anguish about being old. And that's what it means to say that craving is the cause of suffering. You'll find this widely in the mindfulness world. And effectively, it's a secularization of the Four Noble Truth model, which leads to effectively a psychotherapeutic practice. But I think although that can be very valuable and helpful to people, I feel it rétrécit, it narrows, it shrinks the wider context of the practice of the Dharma. And this goes back to the question we had yesterday. If you remove karma, rebirth, and all these other beliefs, then what you are left with is something like MBSR. That was the question. And I don't think that's the case. But we can see very well that if you secularize the Four Noble Truths, you do end up with something just like MBSR. But if we start from a different perspective, not with the truths, but with the tasks, then I feel we're able to retain the broader perspective in philosophical, in contemplative and ethical terms of the practice of the Dharma. So embracing dukkha, letting go of reactivity, seeing its stopping and actualizing a way of life, all of those four tasks are ethical. But their ethics in what Thomas Metzinger called ein Bewusstseinsethik, an ethic of consciousness. It's an inner ethic. And this is something I hadn't really thought about until I heard Thomas's talk, that ethics is not only about the actions we perform that impact the lives of others, but ethics begins with making certain choices within ourselves to act in a certain way. Thomas gave the example of doing mathematical calculations in your head. 2 + 2 = 4. But if we think of this in terms of Dharma practice, then these four tasks are ethical tasks that take place initially within our own minds, within our own consciousness. So if I decide that I will embrace dukkha in a non-reactive way rather than react to dukkha, then I've made an ethical decision within myself that makes a difference to how I lead and live my inner life. Likewise, if I choose to let go of reactivity rather than just let myself be carried away by it, I've made another ethical choice. If I choose to see the stopping of reactivity rather than just ignore that or whatever, I've made another ethical choice. And I think this gives us a very good example of what the foundations of a Bewusstseinsethik might be. But this Bewusstseinsethik, this ethic of consciousness, requires as its foundation a mental autonomy, an inner autonomy. And again, Thomas and also Sophie referred to the ethics of Kant, Immanuel Kant, for whom philosophy is basically is driven by this concern for inner autonomy, this inner freedom, we might say. And it's here that we arrive at the idea of solitude. I'd never thought of it this way until I heard Thomas's talk. I've been writing and studying and thinking about solitude for the last 5 years or so. It never occurred to me that it's actually another way of describing mental autonomy. I'm probably going to have to explain what I mean by that. First of all, when we think of this term solitude, Einsamkeit, we might have the impression it's something relatively straightforward. In other words, if I want to experience solitude, I need to go up onto a mountain or into a monastery or come on a retreat of some sort. And then I'll experience what it's like to be alone. And of course, this is self-evident, really. We talk of people who are solitary in their habits. They don't associate much with other people. They live very much on their own. And the ideal of the meditator who goes into a cave or into a hut in the forest, as the Buddha recommends, is someone who is effectively practicing consciously a solitude. But the Buddha makes a distinction between what he calls kaya viveka, which means physical solitude, and citta viveka, which means mental solitude or spiritual solitude, very close to this geistige Autonomie. And when we look at how the Buddha speaks of this inner solitude, it's very much a form of training. It's a practice. You can't just choose to be inwardly alone. You have to work at it. This is also a distinction that philosophers and mystics in different traditions have recognized. In fact, it's almost a cliche. You know, you go off into the top of the mountain to practice meditation and you find yourself immediately overwhelmed with uncontrollable thoughts and emotions and feelings. And citta viveka, mental solitude, means to be able to be alone in the midst of all of the stuff that comes up in your mind. So solitude as a spiritual practice has to do with training ourselves to be alone in the sense that we're not any longer populated, as it were, by greed and hatred and confusion and pride and so forth and so on. So if we think of solitude in this spiritual sense as creating a free, autonomous space within ourselves, I think we touch upon something very central to the practice of meditation and mindfulness. This is what this practice, in effect, is doing. It's creating and stabilizing an inner space of our own deepest autonomy where we're sufficiently aware and conscious of what's going on, but less and less dictated to or driven by these emotions and thoughts. So solitude, particularly inner solitude, is an art. It's a way of life. It's a practice. It's not something we can switch on and switch off. It's an ongoing moment-to-moment practice. Now, my sense is that solitude or inner autonomy is very close to what we've been describing as non-reactivity, as nirvana. And I think this is suggested very strongly in what might be the earliest of all the early texts that we find in the Pali Canon. There's a group of discourses called the Sutta Nipata. And scholars, as well as traditional Theravada Buddhists, recognize that this text is probably the earliest of all the Pali texts. And one simple reason for that is because it's about the only text that is quoted in other discourses. So there's several occasions where the Buddha is asked a question that runs like this. It says in the Atthakavagga, and then it quotes a verse. What does that mean? Now, this occurs on a number of occasions in the discourses, which means that the monks were already aware and knew these early texts and had questions about them that they then asked the Buddha. This, I think, is quite strong evidence that the Atthakavagga, particularly what's called the Chapter of Eights, the Capitel des Actus, I guess, the Acts, Eights, number eight, Acht. Eight means, it simply means texts with eight verses. In the Atthakavagga, the Chapter of Eights, there are four of these chapters which just have eight verses. And those chapters are probably the core of the Sutta Nipata. And the first verse of the first of those four poems, it's what they're poems really, says this. It's, and I'm going to read it in English, and then, and we may have to translate it. It's, the English is a bit tricky. The creature concealed inside its cell, a man sunk in dark passions, is a long, long way from solitude. A creature concealed inside itself, a person hidden inside a cave, let's say, a cell, a guha in Pali, a sort of hidden place. In other words, you can imagine a person who goes into a mountain retreat and lives inside a cave, let's say. A man sunk in dark passions. In other words, a person who's living in this cave but is completely overwhelmed by their own confusion and their own emotions, such a person is a long, long way from solitude, from mental autonomy. So although such a person gives the impression of being in solitude, they're up on a mountain inside a cave, if you could look inside their mind and see that they're completely caught up in their emotions and passions, then such a person has not really come close to solitude at all, neither by living in the cave, nor by sitting in the cave and just letting their mind go crazy. That's not solitude. It's a long, long way from solitude. This, I think, quite clearly recognizes how solitude is a space, it's a condition that has to be cultivated and developed. Now, we find a very similar idea in Michel de Montaigne, As you are aware, I suspect, Montaigne was a 16th century French politician, diplomat, and essay writer who, at the age of 37, retired from his job as a lawyer in the Parliament of Bordeaux and retreated to a tower on his estate, which is in the Dordogne Valley, and dedicated himself to the practice of solitude. He made a big deal about this. This was how he desperately wanted to live. And he was following the example not of Christian mystics, and certainly not of Buddhist monks, of which he knew nothing at all. He was following the examples of the Greek philosophers, particularly Socrates and Pyrrho, Lucretius, I mentioned yesterday, I mentioned this morning. Lucretius is one of the people Montaigne quotes the most. And what Montaigne sought to do was to emulate the life of the Roman and Greek statesmen, particularly Seneca and Cicero. Remember, Thomas quoted Cicero as saying, "The care of the soul, cultura animi, the care of the soul is philosophy." Very powerful statement. Cicero is a great hero of Montaigne. Montaigne wanted to be like them. But he realized that, I mean, there's a very beautiful passage when he goes into this tower. He makes this declaration that he's going to lead this solitary philosophical life and allow his mind to come to rest and be at ease. But when he starts doing this, he says, "My mind was like a runaway horse," right? A horse that's bolted out of a stable and is wildly running all over the place. He said, "It had neither order nor plan. It was completely chaotic, and he could do nothing about it." And this led him into a deep depression. And to get out of the depression, he decided to make a detailed study of what his mind was doing day to day, moment to moment. And that's when he started writing. He started to describe the actual behavior of his mind. No one had done that before in Western tradition. An honest, what we would now talk of as an autobiographical essay, a psychologically honest autobiographical essay. There's a profound Redlichkeit, honesty, in Montaigne that in many ways is even now slightly shocking, how frank and open he is about himself. And this is what Montaigne has to say about solitude. He says, "Retreat into yourself, but first of all, make yourself ready to receive yourself there." So he's all in favor of retreats, but he says we have to prepare ourselves for a retreat. You can't just sort of wander off into a tower like he did. That didn't work, basically. He says, "If you do not know how to govern yourself, it would be madness to entrust yourself to yourself." Is that clear? If you do not know how to govern yourself, in other words, in a sense, control your mind, then it would be crazy to entrust yourself to yourself. And that's basically what he did. He did something that was crazy. And then he says, in conclusion, there are ways of failing in solitude as in society. We can fail in our social relations with other people, but we can also fail in our own relations with ourselves. In the book I have written called The Art of Solitude, which I've just finished, a quarter of that book is about Montaigne and his practice of philosophy as his discipline of solitude. And there's extraordinary material in the essays of Montaigne that have powerful resonances with the kind of practice we're doing here. It's quite extraordinary, the way he talks about working with his own mind. And yet he knew nothing about Buddhism. Nobody knew anything at that time that the Buddha even existed. It was completely foreign, completely alien. So he's drawing on Western tradition, the Greek traditions, the Roman traditions, that in the 16th century in Europe were being rediscovered. This is, of course, the Renaissance. And Montaigne sought not just to study these Roman and Greek texts, he sought to actually follow their advice and make philosophy into a practice of caring for the soul. He actually sought to practice Pyrrhonian skepticism in 16th century France. And again, this is another passage from Montaigne. He makes this common point that, you know, you can go into a monastery or you can go into a school of philosophy and all of your habits and opinions and emotions will follow you there. You have to do something more than just cut yourself off from society. That is why, he says, it is not enough to remove oneself from people, not enough to just go somewhere else. We have to remove ourselves from the habits of the populace that are within us. This is, we have to isolate our own self and return it to our possession. We carry our chains within us. We are not entirely free. We keep returning our gaze to the things we have left behind. We fantasize about them constantly. Did you follow that, or shall I repeat it? It's okay? Again, we can, for those of us who have, you know, explored the practice of meditation, this is all entirely clear. He says this, I think, very, very well. But going back to the idea of inner autonomy, we have to isolate our own self and return it to our possession. Montaigne is aware, as were some of the classical philosophers, that our minds are constantly leaking out and running away into the world. And this again is a very similar idea to the Buddhist concept of the asava. Asava is usually translated as defilement or something. But actually it means leakage. It's what leaks out. Montaigne felt that his life is constantly leaking out of himself and running off somewhere else. And the practice of philosophy is to prevent that leakage, to keep oneself whole and complete and autonomous, and not to allow oneself to just get lost And in fact, he says in one of his essays that you need to recognize the very first movements in your mind that will develop into a storm or a tempest. And you need to cut them off at the very root, which again is exactly what you do in mindfulness practice. If we go back to Buddhism, we get, I think, a very clear understanding of this inner solitude as a freedom from the hindrances, the obstacles, the hindrances. And there are five hindrances in the early texts. Attraction, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and vacillation, usually translated as doubt. But actually it's this mind swinging back and forth, unable to settle on any point. Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? Should I do that? That's this vacillation, this doubt, this instability. And the practice of meditation, particularly when we talk of collectedness or samadhi or jhana, it starts by our ability to no longer be under the influence of the hindrances. And in fact, it's quite a good exercise, I find, at the beginning of a meditation session, to just check attraction, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, vacillation, just to notice which of those are in some way present within you, to become conscious of what it is that stops or blocks the flow of life. You understand? Oh, five, okay. We have, the first one is attachment or attraction. What's that? That would be Gier oder Anhaftung oder etwas nicht. The second one is the opposite, aversion, hatred, anger. The third is restlessness. I'm sure we've all experienced that. In other words, we just don't feel settled. We're fidgety, itchy. The mind is sort of just looking for something to hold on to. Very common in meditation. The fourth one is the opposite of that, and that is lethargy. In other words, we can't keep our eyes open. We're drowsy, we're sleepy, we're groggy, we're tired. And not even physically tired, we're just sort of mentally dull, if you wish. And the fifth one is this switching back and forth. Now, These hindrances are precisely what prevent inner autonomy or inner solitude. And once we find a quality of awareness and attention that is focused and grounded and still, we begin to experience what the Buddha calls pamoja, which means delight or pleasure. Pamoja is a certain kind of inner contentment and well-being. And that's the foundation, really, for a contemplative practice, is to feel okay, to feel well, to feel content and at ease within oneself. So it is a positive affect. It's not neutrality. It actually feels good. And sometimes we speak of meditation junkies. People who use meditation basically to feel good. And there are practices that can actually intensify those good feelings. In fact, the Buddha has got nothing against that. As you move from pamoja, this contentment, then develops into rapture, a bliss. And it's there that begins the first jhana, the first meditative absorption. The first meditative absorption is characterized by a very strong sense of bliss and rapture and well-being. Again, we don't really need to go into all of that, but the point is, I feel that it's part of this process of inner autonomy entails finding an inner contentment and ease and well-being. Whether it's blissful or not is another story, but that's crucial, really, to pursuing a life of solitude and inner autonomy. Another theme that I explore in this book on solitude is the work of artists. And a quarter of the book, roughly, concerns my reflections upon the art of Johannes Vermeer, the Dutch painter, who I feel shows, reveals the experience of being alone in the most vivid and compelling way, more so than any other artist I can think of. I'm thinking particularly of Vermeer's paintings of solitary women in domestic situations, in a living room, in a kitchen, and they're completely at ease and in harmony with themselves and their environment. I suspect you are familiar with the paintings of Vermeer, so I don't need to say much more, but I've spent a lot of the last few years studying and going to see the paintings of Vermeer. You can't, they don't work in reproduction, or very, very, very minimally. There's nothing to compare with standing in front of one of these artworks. There are only 35 paintings of Vermeer in existence. And one of them has been stolen. Nobody knows where it is. There's 34. And in the last couple of years, I've seen 21 of them. In fact, tonight I'm going to Amsterdam. And tomorrow I want to go to the Rijksmuseum, where they have the Lady in Blue reading a letter. I've not yet had a chance to see that one. But it's not just that certain artists are able to capture what it's like to be human from the inside, which is, I think, what Vermeer achieves. And I can't think of many other artists who've managed to show the Innerlichkeit des Menschen, the inwardness, the innerness of the human person. But I'm also interested in how the practice of art itself is a practice of solitude. The artist, as it were, has to go into retreat. The artist goes into his or her studio. The artist is observing their work, engaged with their work, profoundly alone. It's a very, very solitary activity to be involved in painting, in poetry, in writing, in general. You are on your own. And this, therefore, becomes a practice of solitude. So another figure that I explore and reflect upon in this book is the American abstract painter Agnes Martin. Have any of you heard of her? Agnes Martin? Oh, dear. Well, when you go home, Google her. But Agnes Martin died in about 2006. She lived mainly in New Mexico. And she spent her most productive work of the last 45 years of her life just painting on exactly the same size canvas, squares with lines, pencil lines, and washes of paint in horizontal bars. That's all she did. And she did these by emptying her mind through meditation initially until she learned how to stop thinking. And she would wait for what she calls inspiration. In other words, she consciously and deliberately trained herself to settle and dwell in what she calls an untroubled mind. She wrote an essay, a sort of prose poem, called The Untroubled Mind. It's available as a PDF online. The Untroubled Mind, which is, of course, the Greek ataraxia, the untroubled state that Pyrrho and Epicurus sought to achieve. And when she was in this untroubled state of mind, then these little square images would appear in her mind about the size of a postage stamp. And then she would scale them up to the size of her canvas and reproduce them exactly as they appeared. In other words, she didn't interfere with what inspiration had shown her. And for her, these images were not images of anything in the external world. They were what she understood as pure spiritual qualities, like love, patience, wisdom. They were attempts to show qualities of mind. So again, if you're interested, you can explore her work, but to me, she's a wonderful example of a person committed to the practice of solitude. And she talks about solitude. She's got a number of citations that she said, solitude is my religion. Not just physical solitude, but this inner solitude, this untroubled mind. And I'd like to read to you a quotation from another artist. This is the composer, John Cage. And here is a passage where he's actually talking about painting. He was also a painter. He drew, he painted. And this is what he says about painting. He says, when you start working as an artist, everybody is in your studio. The past, your friends, enemies, the art world, and above all, your own ideas. All are there, even though you are physically alone. But as you continue painting, they start leaving, one by one, and you are left completely alone. Then, if you are lucky, even you leave. as we know, Cage studied with Suzuki in New York. I studied Zen. He practiced the I Ching. He was immersed in Eastern ideas. And probably some of these notions he drew from those sources. The problem is, in our world, that solitude is looked upon with suspicion. If you start talking positively about solitude, you can almost guarantee that somebody's going to object and say, but what about your responsibilities in society? And This is what Agnes Martin said about that. She said, we have been very strenuously, forcefully conditioned against solitude. To be alone in our society is considered to be a grievous and dangerous condition. Now, this fits very well with the work that Thomas Metzinger is doing. Because he recognizes that, and this is Agnes Martin speaking 50 years ago, but today, the experience of solitude is under greater and greater threat than ever from the intrusion of social media, the constant bombardment of data, the fact that my Google phone knows exactly where I am now. It knew where I was in, which restaurant we went to last night, and wanted me to give a comment on the place. In other words, we're less and less alone. We've got big data spying into our lives. And this, I think, is a condition that is only going to get worse. And as Thomas is suggesting, and I think in a very good way, we need to bring into the education, not only of children, but of adults, practices in which their inner autonomy can be restored and grounded. In other words, practices that enable us to be alone. Alone with our own experience and alone with our own clear thinking rationality. As Thomas was saying on Friday, this inner autonomy is supported by Achtsamkeit on the one hand and Vernünftigkeit, rationality, on the other. And that to me, I think, is very, very well put. But I think there is also a paradox of solitude. And this paradox, again, finds itself expressed across traditions. This is Montaigne. He doesn't call it the paradox of solitude. That's my term. But this is what Montaigne says. He says, to tell the truth, confined solitude broadens my horizons and expands me outward. Seems a contradiction. Confined solitude broadens my horizons and expands me outwards. I throw myself into the affairs of state, in other words, political activity, and into the wide world, far more willingly when I am alone. Now, he's not the only person to say this. We find it again and again and again. A very good example is Shantideva. Sylvia was mentioning Shantideva. Shantideva is an 8th century Indian Buddhist monk who wrote this book called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is a great favorite text of the Dalai Lama, and something that I translated from Tibetan when I was a young monk. It's a text I'm very, very familiar with and I greatly admire. But Shantideva follows the same course. He realizes that in order to get his mind under control, in order to govern himself, he needs to find solitude. So he describes going into the mountains. And there's some beautiful passages where he just celebrates being in the natural world with trees and deer and monkeys and no human beings around, where he is effectively dead to the world. He's completely cut off. He says, I am like a dead person. There will be no mourners at my grave. complete isolation. And remember, this is a book about the bodhisattva's way of life, right? Going off into the forest and cutting yourself off from people. And then he settles into meditation. And the first thing he realizes is that he is profoundly interconnected with all other forms of life. It's a very, very beautiful image. He says that he realizes that he is just a cell within a vast organism called life. And just as an organism, a body, would spontaneously reach out if one part of the body is hurt, he says the hand is not in pain, but if the foot is in pain, the hand will automatically try to alleviate the pain of the foot. And he says, likewise, when you realize that you, as an individual person, are simply one person within this body of life, then if another person suffers, you respond to that suffering just like the hand responds to the suffering of the foot. This is a kind of natural, spontaneous compassion that arises out of this understanding of the profound interconnectivity of everything that lives. But in order to get that insight, he had to cut himself off from people. He had to go deep into his own solitude, his own inwardness. And this, I think, is the paradox. The more you go into your own inwardness, you get to a point where suddenly you see the rest of the world looking back. You find yourself seeing the totality of humanity and other forms of life. In other words, we are creatures who cannot, in any absolute sense, ever be alone. The Buddha says, be like an island, right? John Donne says, no man is an island. Both are true. And this is the paradox of solitude. The paradox of the fact that we are the sort of creatures who are unavoidably alone all the time. There's part of what I'm experiencing now that I cannot ever share with you. My own inwardness, as it were. My own privacy, my own private life, how I feel inside myself. And at the same time, we're always embedded in a network of social relations. We're always embedded in a language, which is never ours. It's the shared language of a culture. We're always embedded in the bodies of our parents, that our parents created. It's not our body. Shantideva points this out. And this is the real a core to me of this paradox of being human, is this tension between aloneness and participation. And my first book, the book I wrote, not a translation, but my own book, my own writing, was called Alone with Others. In German, that was Mit anderen allein. I don't think it's available in German anymore. But in many ways, this has been a question that I've been engaged with for 40 years now. And what I'm writing now is, in a sense, going back to this same question. So I'm going to leave that there. We could go on and on. What I'd suggest now is that we have 20 minutes of walking.